This is Looking Forward, conversations about the future of work, brought to you by MillerKnoll.
Hey, listeners. Well, we've reached the end of season three, and I hope you've enjoyed listening to this season as much as we have enjoyed creating it. For this episode, we have three things in store for you today. First, we're going to spend a little time unpacking what we've taken away from our last two episodes. And then we're going to give you a little sneak peek into some recent research that we've been conducting. Finally, I'll share some thoughts with you specifically about the role of offices in supporting new ways of working and how MillerKnoll will use this podcast and other efforts to help you in the future. To kick us off, I'm joined by two of my fantastic team members on MillerKnoll's Global Research and Insights team. Rebecca Horton is a member of our Insights team, leading the sharing of our insights across North America. And Tao Wei is a member of our research team, leading our customer insights research. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you.
You know, our team's gotten much more globally distributed in recent years, but you two are actually in the same city. You're not in the same place today, but tell us, how is Dallas, Texas?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I actually met Rebecca for the first time. It was nice to meet a local friendly face. So Dallas has been great, especially after the Rangers won the World Series. I don't know if, Rebecca, you felt any of that energy kind of spill over.
Yes, it's been an exciting time. And I do remember us meeting, and I was so excited, maybe too excited, to meet someone in data analytics and all the work that you do. So that was fantastic to find someone, you know, like-minded soul. And, you know, we just had our big grand opening, the MillerKnoll showroom in Dallas. So that was exciting this week to be able to have the whole A&D community come out for that. So it's been some cool stuff going on in Dallas.
Good, good. Well, take just a second, if you would, and tell us a little bit about your background and what you do. Maybe, Rebecca, you can kick us off.
Sure. I am a licensed environmental geoscientist by education. And 9 years
of course you are.
I know. It's kind of odd, but yeah, that's a good lead in. I am. And 9 years ago, I was contacted by Miller to come into the family from the world of environmental health, safety, and sustainability. I was at Bombardier at the time. And Miller was looking for individuals to support the client in their design and purchasing journey in the space of sustainability, ergonomics, well-being. And well, here I am. I'm onboarded and I have not left. I provide insights to our clients in the area, the evolution that's going on in these areas. And as our clients grow and their needs expand, I've been encouraged to expand professionally as well.
Excellent. Well, we're thrilled to have you today. Tao, you want to share a little bit about your background and what you do?
Yeah, so I fancy myself a social scientist, have some academic background in sociology, liked it so much that I pursued a master's in applied sociology, which means I focused on research methods, a little bit of public policy, and Rebecca kind of hinted at data and analytics as well. Joined MillerKnoll about 2 years ago, which was a pretty big shift from what my previous industry background was. I had a mix of consumer-facing insights roles, most recently with a QSR, quick service restaurant chain. And then, fittingly enough, because of workplace policy changes and kind of the shift in dynamics of the quarantine, found myself looking for a change and ended up on Ryan's team, which has been a godsend. And a lot of my role focuses on supporting our internal customer teams, usually a mix of retail-focused and contract-focused. And most recently, the largest project we've kicked off has been this global workplace assessment.
And that is the research we're going to give a sneak peek into in just a few minutes. But let me just say, it's such a privilege to work with you both. And you're both so multifaceted. I think you've got fascinating backgrounds. Tao, specifically, hiring you in, knowing that you're a gamer, because for the sake of our listeners, our research, it's way more than workplace. We research health and healthcare environments, gaming, consumer trends. But Tao has helped me to at least kind of understand the world of gaming. So thank you for making me seem a little cooler to my kids.
Definitely.
Let's dive into the last couple episodes, which you both know, these were kind of a passion project. I was so excited to talk about inclusive design and the Harkin Institute. And Rebecca, you didn't mention it in your intro, but you have been so deeply involved in MillerKnoll's DE&IB efforts. I was with our diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging team yesterday. I mentioned that I was going to be talking with you today, and they were all like, oh, Rebecca, I know you earned the place of their heart. So given your passion around inclusion and your work with so many of our customers, I'm just curious, what were the big takeaways for you, either in hearing from Senator and Mrs. Harkin or Kevin and Jason at BNIM?
Yeah, I enjoyed both of those podcasts immensely. Listened a few times. I mean, what an honor to have retired Senator Harkin and his wife, who was just as accomplished, which absolutely blew me away. Mm-hmm. Senator Harkin sharing his theoretical uphill journey of getting ADA passed was just unreal. I actually remember, you know, he talked about the Capitol crawl, which was the Disability Act. It was a march, as it were, on the Capitol to socialize the need for disability services. And I remember seeing that little girl, and now she's 38 years old. But at the time, it was a little girl named Jennifer Keelan, who was determined to crawl the steps all the way up. Talk about an uphill crawl, right? Crawl the steps and to deliver this pamphlet advocating for disability services for herself and all of the people she was representing to the legislature. And you know, my takeaway after listening to these podcasts was like, oh my gosh, what a difference 30 years makes. So from having no accessibility to our own capital in the United States to having the Harkin Institute in Iowa and it being an exemplary facility for individuals who have disabilities, 30 short years. I remember that video as though it were yesterday. And it just is one of those things, once you see it, you can't unsee it. It stuck with me. And listening to that journey and then listening to the BNIM folks, you know, listening to them, I think it was, you know, Kevin, I don't know if it was Kevin or Jason, say that they could really, you know, nerd out about the details of conference rooms and designing that. I was like, wow, these are guys after my own heart. They've been doing it longer than I've been nerding out over conference rooms. And listening to their passion for design for all was, you know, just really hit with me.
Yeah, totally. That connection between specifically buildings and their impact on people's lives is one that we don't often get a chance to draw so directly. But that's one of the things that really stood out to me too. Tao, what were your takeaways? Anything that really struck you that you feel like others can learn from or that we should focus on?
Yeah, to be honest, I had no idea about Senator Harkin's influence and his work on the ADA, which was very enlightening. And hearing about how BNIM designed the Harkin Institute, I had kind of lay eyes on it for the first time. So did some Googling and was really inspired by some of the design elements, which if they weren't explicitly mentioned, I wouldn't have necessarily associated with inclusive design or accommodating different types of disabilities. And just personally, I think it was Mrs. Harkin who mentioned aging in place as a trend. I had some personal experience with that when retrofitting my parents' home when my father was no longer able to kind of climb the stairs on his own. Hearing them talk about it really just kind of brought that back to life, because there were small things that if the home were designed a little bit differently, it would have made the process a whole lot more easy. For instance, the staircase was a little too narrow to fit a stairlift, so we had to widen that. The upstairs bathroom didn't have lipless shower, so we had to retrofit that as well, install grab bars, and just things that are very much obvious and protruding now in their home versus the elements in the Harkin Institute, which just kind of blend and flow very seamlessly. So I think seeing that element of design integrated was really inspiring.
Well, you know, what's interesting is aging in place as kind of a topic is almost always associated with the home, but we have an aging workforce. There's a lot of folks that are not retiring at 60, 65. And when I first came over to Herman Miller in 2012, that was one of the first projects I was introduced to. A researcher by the name of Jim Long had done a project specifically on essentially aging in place in the office, looked at a variety of facets that we've tried to build on in our inclusive design research as well. But yeah, very diverse workforce that includes people that maybe don't want to retire at 65, and we need to be accommodating of their needs in the office as well. Well, one thing that stood out to me, and I just want to give a big shout out to Kevin and Jason on this, is I loved how they took the topic of inclusive design and drew such direct lines to other important organizational priorities like ESG, like the sustainability goals or the DEIB goals of different organizations, which we know are driving real estate decisions. And one of the principles that I find to be so interesting is that being more generous with space is one of the keys to being inclusive, which is pretty timely And you probably heard my reaction to it at the time. I'm like, yes, given that a lot of organizations might feel like they have extra square meters or square feet of space instead of just divesting of it, what does it look like to transform the space to be more inclusive with some of that extra square footage? I thought their connecting all these dots was a really wonderful part of the conversation.
Absolutely. Let's do something productive and useful with the space to expand what we know about placemaking and making people feel welcome in where they work.
I'm glad you brought up that term of placemaking and just place design, because that really is what this is all about. I mean, if we look at urban planning, the role of art as an example in placemaking and really defining how a space can be transformed from a blank slate into something that's really relevant for that culture. I do think that's what's happening here. And I think there's organizations that have maybe pivoted from some of the traditional objectives of offices in terms of how they present the brand, so to speak, and instead are really trying to find that way of reflecting who the employees are and what the employees need the space to do. Other things that stood out?
I have to mention, coming from a place of movement and a place of overall well-being, our Jason Rosenblatt worked along with Jason Cruz and Kevin Nordmeyer and really drawing out, you know, the individual elements, Tal mentioning the aging in place, the ability to move and to accommodate yourself in your own space. That is so important. And not only for individuals who are aging in place, but for individuals who've had incurring a disability. We're all going to, as my dear friend, Phyllis Marshall Rice, who is a designer with MillerKnoll and specializes in ADA design and in healthcare. He reminds us that at some point we'll all come into contact with either ourselves being disabled or a family being disabled. So planning for that and acknowledging that either ourselves or someone that we know will have, you know, something that requires
some sort of limitation, right?
Some sort of limitation, and needs some sort of accommodation. So whether that be, you know, a sit to stand desk, you know, one of our biggest advocates for sit to stand desks are our veterans. So like, you know, I jumped out of one too many helicopters, Rebecca, my back kills me if I have to sit all day, and recognizing those needs and supplying that to populations that benefits all of us, right? It's that cut curb theory. Cut curb was part of ADA, and it facilitates being able to move a wheelchair up and down, but it helps everyone. If you're walking and you know, you're not supposed to, but if you're walking and you're looking at your phone, you're not going to trip on a curb. You're going to be able to kind of keep an eye, a mindful eye out as you walk. If you have a stroller, you're dragging, you know, a cart with something in it. It just helps us all to have that, what once was seen as an accommodation, but just to have that accessible to us. That was a big takeaway of seeing the images and what they've done with the Harkin Institute.
Yeah, I think that came through for me too. I sense that in some cases, people view accommodations, if it's an existing facility, as being an either expensive or potentially ugly retrofit. But this came out in the conversation. When you are intentional about this upfront, it can not only be affordable and beautiful, but it just serves everybody. A lot of these specific accommodations for someone that has unique needs just results in a solution that everybody enjoys more. There were a variety of facets about the facility that I think met that standard. Well, good. I appreciate both of your perspectives on that. Now I want to get back to something that Tao mentioned briefly, which is a new research project that you, Tao, have led for us called the Global Workplace Assessment. You mentioned it's a global study. In this case, it was a quantitative study. Can you give us just a little sense of the nature of it and what we did?
A few months ago, we teed up our largest study, at least in my memory, got about 5,000 plus respondents across 9 different regions globally. And it was really just kind of meant as a health check on the state of workplace trends. Think like workplace policy, how well working spaces were accommodating people's needs for different types of activities and work, including those who have either a hybrid, fully remote, or fully in office work policy. So some of the findings were pretty enlightening, especially if you cut by different regions. There were a couple of tidbits that did jump out at us.
Well, I want to dive into that, but I'm going to give just a little bit of additional context too, because I have a feeling many of our listeners know that we were part of a fantastic collaboration that lasted a couple of years called Future Forum, started by Slack, but also Boston Consulting Group, a group called MLT, and then MillerKnoll were all involved in doing joint research, big surveys, 10,000 people every quarter. And that lasted for a couple of years. I'm still in very close touch with our collaborators there. We like to share what we're learning with each other. For me, this was a chance of doing a really broad quantitative look with more of a focus on place. So we wanted to still keep track of all those work trends that we discovered so much about in Future Forum, but we needed data on, okay, what do people really think of their facilities? What kind of work location policies really exist across the globe? And knowing that so many of the headlines about what's happening with the office originate from media outlets in cities like New York and London, it gave us a chance to take a much more broader and in maybe some ways more balanced perspective on what was happening. So unpack for us a little bit about what we learned.
We can start off with workplace location policy. So that's really the policy governed by the employer organization itself. And about 50% of companies have fully in office policies right now globally. About 37-38% have hybrid policies whereby employees are spending at least one day in the office. And then the remainder is fully remote. So roughly about 13-14% are fully remote.
Mm-hmm. This to me is definitely a more diverse perspective on how work is happening. And the fact that I think it was 49%, right? Or nearly 50% of organizations are fully, or at least have a fully in-office policy, might surprise some. And in particular, knowing that remote first policies were relatively rare, I think was eye-opening.
Yeah. So with about 50% of companies having a fully in-office policy, some of that remote portion is being tipped by the US and Canada specifically. Both of them had about a quarter or 24-25% stating that they have fully remote, but the rest of the regions are almost sub 10%. It's kind of a skew towards countries that have very remote first policies, maybe governed by their industry, but overall it's still pretty in office or hybrid.
Yeah, it is very interesting that specifically the US and Canada, if I remember right, were the only two that had more than 20% of the organizations having remote first policies compared to the other countries. Even Australia, if I remember right, was like under 10%. So I think the headlines about remote versus in the office, which many of us have grown a bit tired of, probably relate to just a few countries around the world where maybe that tension is felt a little bit more. But in a lot of places, people are either working for organizations that are fully in the office or are hybrid. Of those that are hybrid, we asked how much time people are spending in the office. Can you tell us what the results were?
Yeah, so the trend tends to be around 2 or 2.5 days for a typical work week. Again, Canada, UK, and US are trending towards that 2 mark, but regions like Brazil, India, and Japan, they lean more 2.5, almost to 3 for Japan specifically. So it's kind of just in that mix of half the week is in office, half the week is elsewhere, typically at home.
Yeah. And I remember seeing scores in Brazil and India being higher than most. It brought to mind our conversation on this podcast with Pallavi Srivastava, who joined this season to talk a little bit about this new generation of workplace that's happening in India and how focused it is on gathering people together.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's telling of my own blind spots when it comes to different regions and the trends that we may not see firsthand. So having team members in India on the ground is really, really beneficial when it comes to this type of work. Not only is it a good internal check, but the wisdom of crowds, you can kind of benefit from other people's perspectives when they have the lived experience that we don't.
Love the global perspectives. Rebecca, I know that the data is new to you, but were there any takeaways or impressions you had when you took a peek?
I like to make connections. That's what kind of one of the ways my brain works, making connections. And when I saw this work and the mix of in-office and hybrid, I couldn't help but think of during pandemic, tying back to individuals with disabilities, Department of Labor saw an uptick in their employment because of the ability for them to control their environment. And making the connection back to the work that the Harkin Institute is doing to provide these spaces that are so accommodating all in a seamless way that you don't even realize you're being accommodated, and saying, all right, what can we learn from that? And designing spaces in the office to where everyone, you don't have those impediments. You don't have groups that are saying, I need to stay behind because my office is just not quite accommodating me. I just see this as a golden opportunity to connect all these dots. And if people have the desire to come in, even if it is they want to come in once a week, they have the ability to be fully accommodated.
Well, we've definitely seen evidence in our research and others that providing more flexibility does provide greater accommodation for those with unique needs. If 50% or roughly 50% of the organizations represented by those we surveyed have fully in-office policies, then boy, that burden to make sure that these are very inclusive, accommodating experiences is real high. And that's a good tie between the two topics. One thing that I definitely want to focus on before we leave this one of the most surprising bits, which is, Tao, we asked those that are working in organizations that have a hybrid policy about the amount of time they spend in the office, but we also cut it by distance from the office or commute time. How impactful is the commute in terms of determining how much time people are spending in the office?
Well, it turns out, as of this study, not very impactful at all. So there was no statistically significant relationship between the nearest office in terms of commute time and the amount of time they're spending in the office. So we have a couple of theories about why that might be happening. Some of it may just be the normalization of their organization's workplace policy. So they know the drill, they're expected to be in office 2 days a week, or maybe they've worked out something with their teams where A team is here, B team is here. There may be some self-selection bias too. So maybe they've moved to companies that have clearly defined commute and work location policies. So there's a minimization of that. And there was one thing that's kind of out of left field that I've been noticing. Some other news outlets are reporting the rise of super commuting. So a lot of companies instituted fully remote policies during the height of the pandemic. So naturally, employees kind of took advantage of that. They may have moved to lower cost of living areas or maybe relocated to be closer to family, whatever reasons they may have had. And now those may be changing where their employers are expecting at least 1 to 2 days in office or, you know, reporting into their local facility. So rather than give up the work-life balance or other benefits of living away from the office, they're just resigned to that super commute. And some people are spending upwards of an hour to 90 minutes commuting to the office. Some are spending even more than that. So it just goes to show that people will naturally adapt to the conditions.
This data that you spoke of basically indicated that regardless of if somebody is like within 15 minutes or even 30, 45 minutes, that the amount of time in the office varied relatively little. And I've also been talking with just some of our thought partners and others about it and have reached a similar conclusion to what you just said, which is, I don't know that the variance that we saw in 2021 or 22 is there anymore. It's like, if you're going to the office, you know why. Either you're going there for a very specific meeting or experience, or because you're required to, or because you've chosen to work in an organization that kind of reflects your balance. And as we've seen in other studies, getting in the office 2 to 3 days a week is about what people want. And that's what was pretty much reflected. So it was different than in 2021, where it was like, yeah, I guess I should go into the office. But you were kind of like, I'm not exactly sure why I'm going in. And the difference between 10 minutes and 45 minutes probably was a key determinant. The net out for me is, I think we've seen some stabilization. That was my personal reflection, was seeing all the data from this study. I'm like, okay, I think we're in a zone. We're in a vibe now. Like, we get that people are splitting their time in many cases, but in many parts of the world, you know, it's fully in office, that the commute may be having less of an impact and there may be less variability than what we saw. For better or for worse, I think we've hit some degree of normalization in working policy and the way people are spending their time.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that.
All right, Rebecca, any additional thoughts?
That's exciting for me, just to have those conversations from a human perspective. And it helps us to understand the why. And we've heard this again and again from our research. We want to have choice in place, but we also want to have choice in time. So the when is just as important as the where. You know, do I have to help someone take meds at a certain point in the daytime because I'm their caregiver? Or do I have to deliver someone to school, make sure they get there safely? So it's okay to have those conversations now in the workplace, you know, those human conversations with our managers, because that, you know, that just lightens our cognitive load. We can be ourselves, bring our whole selves to work, as we say. And that was one of the takeaways that I've been so grateful for in your research, Tao, and then our overall research at MillerKnoll.
One of the things that maybe isn't reflected in all the conversations about work location policy is that I, just having been more involved in the HR world in the last few years, I've noticed that a lot of organizations have dialed up their emphasis on empathetic management. So even if you've got a fully in-office policy, that doesn't mean that employees shouldn't be able to address the things you just just described, even if they're hourly workers, like working in a manufacturing or distribution environment. And so location policy is one thing, but boy, having an empathetic manager that wants to make sure that you can attend to your life's needs is probably one of the most important things any organization can do to promote the well-being and retention of their employees.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's about having that dialogue, and to kind of tie it back to the Harkin Institute. When they were talking about the Institute Disability Policy Committee and having that conversation, I think that saying that came up was nothing about us without us. So that really does apply broadly, universally. So if companies are trying to define their location policies, just having that conversation, including the employees that it's going to affect most, is really key.
Awesome. I love how you took that principle, nothing about us without us, and broadened it to that more empathetic, employee-centric, inclusive approach to design and supporting work. Yeah, I love that. All right, you two. Thankful for both of you. Appreciate your perspectives. All right, listeners, as I mentioned before, I want to talk a little bit about the challenges facing the workplace today and how we at MillerKnoll want to continue to find new ways to help you navigate them. For the past three seasons, we've looked forward together on this podcast at the future of work, talking with all sorts of experts in the worlds of research and workplace strategy, real estate, and design about their thoughts on what's next and what's coming in the future and how we can all prepare. But we have heard from you, meanwhile, that you have very immediate pressing needs. You've shared with us that you're concerned about the future, but you need help today, given the immediate challenges in the worlds of real estate and the need for your spaces to deliver greater value to your employees and your leaders. We also know that depending upon where you are in the world, this can look very different, but all of it relates to place and finding ways of improving our places in the midst of all the economic uncertainty and other challenges that we're all facing. So there's a few new initiatives that we've got going that I hope that you'll be as excited about as I am to support you. First, we're launching a new point of view on how the workplace can best address today's challenges that we're calling Design with Impact. Recognizing that most of the changes that we've been talking about for the last few seasons actually were occurring before the pandemic and have really been accelerated in recent years, we're going to dive into three themes that we've identified: well-being, connection, and change, that we know were proven to deliver greater value for organizations and their employees in the midst of these challenges. If our places of work can help promote rather than detract from employee well-being, connect people within and across teams, and greater facilitate change, then regardless of an organization's industry or work location policy or geography, we know that employees and leaders find great value in these. You can already find articles addressing these topics that'll help you assess new opportunities for improvement at your organization on our website, MillerKnoll.com, under the Insights tab. And furthermore, we're launching a series of talks and roundtables in cities around the world focused on these themes that I and members of my team will be conducting in the coming months. But beyond that, we've also shifted our perspective and reimagined this podcast, inspired by the changes that we're experiencing today. We're calling this next chapter About Place. Beginning with season four, About Place will explore the changing role of place in our lives at work, but also beyond, with an emphasis on practical strategies that can be applied today to help your organizations now, but also in the future. So to wrap, I want to say thank you. It's been a great season. I'm so thankful for our guests throughout season three, but most of all, I'm thankful to you for listening, for investing your time. I hope that we're serving you well, and I can't wait to kick off season four this spring as we dive into a host of fascinating topics about place.